doing Parshat Behar. Yes. And our parsha focuses firstly on the mitzvah of Shemitah. Our parsha then speaks about the cycle. 6 years of work, seventh year rest, seven cycles bring us to the year Yovel, which people tend to translate Jubilee. Then we have the mitzvah of Batei Arei Choma, that if you have a house in a city that's walled, so then you have a year to buy it back. After the year passes, if you didn't buy it back, then that house does not go back to its original owner. The Torah gives us a mitzvah. If our relative has to sell their property, we have a mitzvah to buy it, to keep it in the family. We have a mitzvah when we sell property to calculate how many years are left to Shemitah, to Yovel, because we realize that at the Yovel, at the Jubilee year, so the houses have to go back. We have the cities of the Levites. So the cities of the Levites, even though they might be walled, it doesn't matter. You can always redeem a property from there. We have a mitzvah, if you sold a property, don't redeem it within the first 2 years. Someone bought a property, they didn't mean for you to buy it back tomorrow. So even though you're allowed to buy it back, you give them 2 years, except for the Levite cities. There, they're always allowed to buy it back. The Torah tells us if someone needs a loan, help them out. Don't take interest. We have a mitzvah, v'chei achicha imach, patronize Jewish stores, Jewish workers. Don't take interest. We'll get back to that. We have a mitzvah if we have to purchase our fellow man. If he's so impoverished that he sells himself, we have to treat him respectfully. And then the Torah tells us what happens if a Jew sells himself to a non-Jew. So then we have a mitzvah to buy him back. Don't let him work in slavery for other people. The Torah concludes the parasha with the commandment not to set up mosaic floors that people would bow on. People sometimes had this was a form of idol worship. They would set up mosaic floors with all kinds of designs. So that's prohibited in the Torah. And the Torah concludes with the mitzvah of Shabbos, which obviously needs some work while that's showing up here. So let's begin. Yes.
You see, like the turn of the millennium, like a little over 2,000 years ago, you see like a lot of Jewish mosaics from like synagogue floors from synagogues and much over that.
Okay. They weren't worshipped. Huh? They didn't worship those floors.
I know, but you could. Isn't that like a little awkward of a line that like you still make the floor of your house of worship the mosaic or the part specifically you've done?
Remind me, we'll get back to that, okay?
It was the same thing, because there's this shul in Jericho.
Right. No. So we'll get back to that. Let's start. Yes. Mr. Hassan, you...
I have questions later.
Okay. So the Torah tells us the mitzvah of Shemitah. It says, God told Moshe at Sinai the following mitzvah and tells us the mitzvah of Shemitah. So what's going on here? Why is it specifically at Mount Sinai, where we've already left Mount Sinai? It's telling us a general rule that all the mitzvahs were given at Sinai with the details. We have mitzvahs written throughout the Torah. Some of the mitzvahs are written at the end of 40 years, like the mitzvah of Tefillin. Where does it say the parasha of Shema? In Bet Hanan, at the very end of the Torah. So they weren't wearing tefillin 40 years in the desert. All the mitzvahs were given at Sinai. They were written interspersed. The mitzvah of divorce is written at the end of the Torah in Kisetze. So there were no divorce. There was no capacity for divorce before the end of the 40 years in the desert. All the mitzvahs were given at Sinai. Yet they were written in different places in the Torah. So that's why this mitzvah reiterates that point and says this mitzvah was given at Sinai, even though it's recounted over here. And we have the mitzvah of Shemitah. So Shemitah is generally you're letting the land rest. What does that mean? You're letting the land rest. You're not allowed to plow. You're not allowed to harvest. You're not allowed to prune. So there's a very specific type of pruning. It's called zimirah. Zimirah. Zimirah is a specific type of pruning which very few trees need. the grapevine, if you don't prune it properly, will die. So the Torah comes and says, don't prune your grapevine on Shemitah. So the truth is that the people who own orchards, who own vineyards, invest a tremendous amount of work preparing for Shemitah. Because if you let those grapevines grow and you don't deal with them at all, they will die. You will not have a vineyard after Shemitah. So there are systems as to how we work the vineyard. The trees must be pruned in this way that's called zimira. Now, there are very few trees that share that characteristic with the grapevine. Most trees will do okay without it. But the Torah says you cannot work the land or the trees on Shemitah. So now, all around the country, you'll see many, many farms that are not working on Shemitah. What about watering your crops? So our assumption is that we have the prototypes, we have the avot, the prime tasks that are prohibited, which is plowing, planting, harvesting, yes? And then you have the derivatives, which follow in nature but are not explicit, like watering the crops. When we speak about the derivatives, the toladot, so there we have a distinction. We have something called ukme ilana and avruye ilana. You have sometimes where if you're not going to do it, everything's going to die. Imagine a guy who has brand new grass. He bought a new house, he moved in, and now he has brand new grass on his yard. He's not going to water it. Everything's going to die. A person has a bed of roses. They're all going to die. So when it comes to ukme ilana, to keep it alive, so there, when it's not the prime tasks that were prohibited in the Torah, when it's derivatives, we're more lenient. But when it comes to avruye ilana, your tree is doing okay, but if you watered it, it would be so much better. Fertilizing your lawn. Your lawn's okay, but if you fertilized it, oh wow, it would grow amazing. So then that we don't do on Shemitah. We don't do avruye. When we speak about the derivatives of the tasks, we don't do things that would just benefit the crop, but are not critical for the crop. What about your vase at home? What about the flowers you have at home? So there's a big machlokas about flowers, whether Shemitah is relevant to flowers, because they're not edible. Our rule is that Shemitah applies to the land. The land has to rest. And what about the crops? So it applies to things that are edible by humans, by animals, or can be used even for paints. Even if you use it for paint. What about a flower? You're not using it for anything. You enjoy the look, but you're not using it for anything. What about if a flower has smell? So this is a big source of discussion where some commentaries hold that Shemitah does apply and others hold that not. In a second, I'll get to you, Benny. But you're not allowed to plant on Shemitah. Are you allowed to plant inside the house in a flower pot? That's a machlokas. Some say yes, some say no. You're in the house in a flower pot. Okay, those who need to, there's room to be lenient. Yes?
Two things. I don't know if it's just a modern Hebrew thing, but a mazmera is clippers, right?
That's a mazmera, yeah.
So, but like the kind of pruning that is done with the grapes is different. How's it different?
Because it's critical and it promotes the growth of the grapevine. It's different than the pruning you do with another tree, which promotes its growth, but it's not critical.
And when you were talking about things that were edible by humans or by animals, and your grass example, most people that have grass don't have sheep. You know, like they throw out their grass.
Right.
Does that fall under the category?
I'll get back to you in a second. Okay. Yes.
Is it still Shemitah? Technically, it's not actually growing from the ground itself, like the earth.
What do you mean?
It's like you mentioned before, a potted plant. It's from earth, but it's not like from like karka. It's not from like.
It's a long answer.
Okay. Also, it's same. I guess. Kind
Thursday
of
night. Okay.
Huh?
Thursday night. We'll discuss it. Beautiful. There's a concept in halacha called atzitz nakuv or atzitz sheino nakuv, whether the flower pot has a hole, does not have a hole, what material it's made out of, where it's located, where the top of the plant is. There's a lot to discuss, which you can do on Thursday.
Discussion on whether it's the field of the man.
Nope. Just a second, Ephraim, are we done? That was it?
The second part, but it's more the same idea that it you grow something in a greenhouse, like people grow lettuce or mushroom pizza, and they use the iridescent lights, and it's not actually also from the ground. And that's also
hydroponic. In a nutshell, there are a few factors to the question. Factor number one is, how is it separated from the ground? Because our sages said something which science has borne out in recent years, and that is that if you have a flower pot, if you have a plant growing in a pot, and there are holes in the pot, so then the plant actually gets nutrients from the ground. So this is discussed in Talmud, that the plant draws nutrients from the ground. The question is, what constitutes a separation between the plant and the ground? What they found is that if you have, let's say, a flower pot in your home sitting on the tiles, if you lift the tile, you will find the earth has shifted towards the flower pot. And this is what our sages described, that plants will suck nutrients from the ground through earthenware. Many of the tiles are made of earthenware. Okay, we call it ceramic, we use other terms, but they're actually made of earth, many of the tiles we have. So, and even through cement, they found that the plants can suck, as you find that grass can grow through cement, so plants can also draw nutrients through cement. So that's a question number one. Is your plant drawing nutrients from the ground? And that's the topic which I wanted us to leave for Thursday night, the discussion of atzitz nakuv and atzitz sheino nakuv. Is my flower pot with a hole or without a hole? Is there something separating it from the ground? That's question number one. Then there's another question. Even if I have a flower pot and I have steel under it, I know it's not connected to the ground. So there's question number two, and that is, does the top of the flower pot go, does the top of the plant go over the pot? Because then the top parts of the plant also draw nutrients from the ground. Then there's question number three, which is, am I growing it in a manner that is conducive to its growth normally, or am I growing it in a home where it's not so conducive to its growth? So some plants do, you grow them in a greenhouse all year long. So comes Shemitah, when you grow them in the greenhouse, you didn't do anything different. So there it's not so clear that a greenhouse would absolve you from the rabbinic obligations of Shemitah. Other plants, you don't grow in a greenhouse. If I am not mistaken, peppers are not ordinarily grown in a greenhouse. It's not good for them. I hope I'm not getting it backwards, but that's what I remember. So then if you would grow them in the greenhouse, you only have to worry about question number one and question number two, but question number three technically would be okay.
So, Rabbi?
Yeah.
A certain well-known type of plant grows on the substrates inside a house with plastic foil under it. That would be allowed.
I don't know what we're talking about.
It's a certain herb some people like to take to themselves, and they grow it like on a stone wool or other kind of substrates, and then they put like a plastic foil under it.
I'll tell you, I don't know. I earlier, were you here when we studied the Sefer Amidot?
I did remember we studied it, yeah.
Yeah, so that's where I mentioned that some things are harmful, and some things are not permitted all year long. It's not a question of Shemitah. So we discussed that. I'm not sure what you're talking about, in all honesty.
Oh, yeah.
I bet met. I'm not sure what we're talking about, but I'm not sure I want to know either. So
It's a kind of plant which would be
right.
Not legal in this country.
Let's move on.
Okay. So throughout Jewish history, and that's actually the topic of our Haftarah, the Jewish people weren't too good at keeping this mitzvah. As a matter of fact, it doesn't seem like we did more than once or twice the way we should. And so the rabbis looked for solutions. One solution was to bring in the prophet and yell and warn and threaten. And that didn't work. The first temple was destroyed, the people were exiled, and the prophet tells them, you will be exiled 70 years, corresponding to the 70 Shemitah cycles that you have transgressed. So that's Rashi in numerous places goes into how to do that calculation. So that didn't work. So then in the second temple, again, they ran into big problems. So one of the solutions was they imported. The rabbis worked on imports so people would have food. I think in our generation, people are so finicky, it blows my mind. I tell people, there's a question about whether you can do this process with tomatoes. And they say, you want me not to eat tomatoes? And I say, what's so terrible if you don't eat tomatoes? So you won't eat tomatoes for 1 year. And what about the nutrient factors of tomatoes? So, you're so worried about the leopectin? So fine, you can get tomato paste, eat more pizza. Put tomato sauce on your food. If you're really worried about the nutrients, it happens to be that modern research shows that the food that's canned retains so many properties, you'll get much more of the nutrients from the canned food than the vegetable you eat. You don't eat enough tomatoes. So go buy some awesome ketchup and you're okay. Ah, so no, we LMI, I like having a tomato on my sandwich. I also like having a tomato on my sandwich, but that's not a reason to do all kinds of far-fetched, questionable leniencies in Shemitah. If you have a good leniency, you could rely on good. So we discussed, we had a whole class on this. But in the days of Chazal, when they needed a leniency, they were dying of hunger. When Rav Kook was dealing with the question of Heter Mechira, you were talking about people dying. When Rav Kook dealt with the Heter Mechira, you had a situation where the establishment in Israel was in danger. There was a danger to the crops, to the farmers. There was a serious danger here. So there were a few leniencies that were developed. The first one was developed in the period of the Second Temple. What the rabbis did was the courts moved in and took over the fields. And by taking over the fields, they could ensure that the crops were distributed properly between the people, and they could ensure that people were not working their fields improperly on Shemitah. So then they would hire the farmer whose field it was, and they would tell him, look, it's our field now, because you have to let the field go fallow. If you just let the field go fallow, we know what's going to happen. There's Al Capone down the block, and he's going to come in with his men, take all the crops, no one will have food. So we, the courts, took over your field. We need to hire someone to pick the crops. We, as the court, will distribute it to the masses, but we'll pay you. And so they took the farmers, and they hired them as their workers to harvest and do the permissible acts, and then the courts would distribute the food. This became known as Otsar Beit Din. And that's what you have till today. You have certain farmers who have given over their crops to the courts, and if you want, here in this neighborhood, we have numerous families that will distribute the foods of Shemitah. That food is holy. That means you're not allowed to just discard it. You have to eat it. And if you don't want to eat it, so you put it on the side. And if your child ate half a banana, so you give the other half to your animals. This is where the question of animals comes up. And if you don't own animals, so you could throw it out. Preferably respectfully, we wrap it up. We don't throw it out disrespectfully because the food has holiness. Slowly. You're not supposed to give food that's fit for human consumption to an animal, but once your child's eaten half the banana, if you're not finicky, you eat the other half. And if you are finicky and you don't want to eat it and no one wants to eat it, so then you can give it to the animal. You peel your carrots. So the carrot peel is edible, but no one feels like eating it. So you give it to your rabbit. You give it to other animals. You don't have animals, okay, so then you can wrap it, put it in a bag, put it in the garbage. You could really put it in the garbage without a bag. So Otsar Beis Din, if you go to the houses around the neighborhood that have Otsar Beis Din, they will charge you a certain sum for the food because they have to cover the costs. Bringing the food here cost money. Hiring someone to harvest it cost money. So it's much cheaper or a little bit cheaper than the stores, but nonetheless, there is a certain cost because there is a certain amount of work that goes into it. So that's Otsar Beis Din. A Heter Mechira you guys know about. Let's move forward. The Torah tells us, blow shofar, pass the air through a shofar on Yom Kippur as part of the Jubilee year. From the terminology, pass the air through a shofar, we understand that shofar comes from the word shofaret. It's like a pipe. From there we learn the definition of a shofar. What is a shofar? A shofar is the outer layer of a horn that has two layers, an inner bone and an outer layer. From the terminology in our parsha. So the outer layer is really a pipe. How do you make a shofar? You put it in boiling water, and then you pull out the bone, and you end up with the shofar. How do you make a shofar? You bury the shofar in the ground, and then worms come and eat the inner bone, and then the outer shofar remains. Those are two possible ways of doing it. So how do you make a shofar? You boil the shofar in water, and because the pipe is so circular, if you're an Ashkenazi who doesn't have the Yemenite tradition of putting it in the ground with worms, after you've boiled the shofar in water, it becomes flexible, and you straighten it out. Why must you straighten it out? Because we don't have drills that do this. Okay, so your drill goes straight. So you straighten it out, and then your drill, you can drill through it. So we have different ways of making shofarot. The Yemenites is the most ancient, probably, where they just bury the shofar in the earth for a period, and the worms will eat away at the inside, and that's how they could get these squiggly shofarot. If the shofar isn't too complicated, you could boil it and pull out the bone. And then if you're Ashkenazi, so then you straighten it out and you drill and you do it the Western way. You notice I'm not such a fan, even though I'm Ashkenazi. Okay, En malasot. Back to our parsha. So that's learned from here. We have the mitzvah of Yovel. We're not exactly sure when it is. So after the 49, we have a 50th year. And then everyone gets back their land. It's like the reset button. Everyone goes back to their family property. And again, people were not good at this. People didn't keep this. In the days of Jeremiah already, they didn't keep it. Yovel is relevant when the majority of the people of Israel are in Israel. According to Maimonides, we each have to live in the proper tribe. So even though we're almost there, meaning most of the people of Israel are almost here, it's only a number of years and most of the Jews will be living in Israel. According to Maimonides and other opinions, many of the mitzvot do not yet take effect biblically because we don't know where each tribe is supposed to live. None of us know what tribe we're from, aside from the Kohanim and Levim, right? So we don't have that. I don't have time for questions. We're out of time. After class. The Torah tells us, V'lo tonu ishet amito. Do not afflict your fellow man. What does that mean? That means you're selling him the property, but you know you're getting it back in 45 years or 40 years or whatever number it is till the Jubilee year. So charge a fair price. So from here we learn a mitzvah. Charge a fair price. If the guy's a newcomer, you're a taxi driver, he's sitting there and he asks you, what's the fare? And you say 35. And then when you get there, he pulls out $35. Tell him, no, I said 35, I meant 35 shekel. Right? You have to be honest with him. Lo tonu ishet amito. You're not allowed to take advantage of someone on things that have a set price and a fair price. You're not allowed to cheat them. Lo tonu ishet amito. The Torah reiterates it and tells us, do not afflict your fellow man. From there, we have a biblical prohibition of saying something hurtful. Meaning, it says it once to tell us not to do an act in business that's hurtful, that's unfair. And it tells us a second time to tell us not to say something hurtful. That's the biblical prohibition of saying any word that would hurt someone else. Now this goes beyond what we would think. Let's say you're walking down Mea Shaharim and you're boiling hot. And you really want some shade, but there's no shade. And it's 115 degrees out there. You're not sure what to do. So you see a jewelry shop. So you walk in. And there's great air conditioning there. And you say, can you show me a pair of cufflinks for about 500 shekel? So the guy says, gee, I'm sure I had some here somewhere. And then he goes rummaging. And you find the exact spot that the air conditioning is hitting you. You don't plan on buying no cufflinks. But he's going to go looking and searching. Cufflinks, cufflinks, cufflinks. Where do I have that? So you're putting him to work for what? For nothing, because you want to enjoy the air conditioning, right? It says you're not allowed to do that. Part of the prohibition, don't afflict your fellow man verbally, is a commandment not to waste people's time. Not to tell someone, I might buy this if you're sure you're not going to. You want to see what the latest Harry Potter book is saying. So you run into the store and you say, do you have the latest Harry Potter book? So they pass it to you and they go out of their way and they bring it to you. You have no intention of buying it. You're interested in reading the overview or whatever, flipping to the last pages so you can talk to your friends and make sure you know something, right? Okay, I don't read Harry Potter, I have no idea. But at any rate, that's not right. You're not allowed to make the guy work or make him feel like you're going to buy something when you know full well you won't. Okay, we move forward. We discussed Batei Choma, that you're not supposed to, when the city is walled, there are special laws. What happens when a person needs a loan? So there's a mitzvah to help him out. So the Chafetz Chaim says, don't be stupid. Giving a loan doesn't mean losing your money. Take collateral. I was at Mr. Ad Apnim the other day. A guy asked me for my pen. I said, can I have your 2 detzahut? So he looks at me like, I just asked for a pen. I said, I just asked for 2 detzahut. He says, I'll give you back your pen. I said, I'll give you back your 2 detzahut. So he says, I need my 2 detzahut. I'm in Mr. Ad Apnim. I'm filling out forms. I said, a credit card is okay also. So he gave me his credit card. I got my pen back. Sure enough, works. Neighbors come and ask you to borrow your instruments. So if you've lent them twice, you probably will not do it a third time. Because by the second time, chances are you didn't get it back. And if you got it back, it was a long time later. I lent a wrench to a friend of mine, a really good friend, and I didn't remember I lent it to him. I was smart. I even put a label on it with my name. You know, I got one of those key labels. I put in a loop, I had my name on it, I lent him the wrench, and sure enough, about 2 years later, I didn't remember I had lent it to him, and I'm looking all over for the wrench. So I said, okay, I must have dropped it somewhere, you know. I'm going to have to go and buy a new wrench. Fortunately, he brought it back. But by the time he brought it back, 2+ years later, I didn't even remember I lent it to him. So, again, says the Chafetz Chaim, take collateral. If you take the guy's driver's license, he will remember to bring you back your wrench. He will. And if he doesn't, you'll remember because you'll have his driver's license. So very often, we hold back on doing this mitzvah. We don't give loans because we're scared of not getting it back. Why? Take collateral and give the loan. Do not take interest. So here, we're running out of time. Sorry. The Torah calls interest neshech. Neshech means bite. Because when we pay interest, we think it's not a big deal, but we don't realize the bite down the road. There are certain things I wish you could promise me you wouldn't do. And one of them is what's called the gray market. The gray market is a market where you can get a loan real easy because they have a George that breaks people's legs. And they give you a loan and the conditions are such that you will pay interest the rest of your life. There are many taxi drivers who have taken a 30, 40, 60,000 shekel loan because they were in the middle of a divorce settlement and they needed the cash. But they took it from this market that's called the gray market. And now, let's say they took 60,000 shekels. Well, the way the interest is built, they have to pay back 10,000 shekel a month. And they're still paying primarily interest. They're going to pay off the loan in about 80 years. So they're never going to pay off the loan. So this is a market that's called the gray market. Whatever happens, you better go to jail, but don't take a loan from there. Because that's a death sentence. Because you can't get out of it, and you can't fight them. They know where you live, and you know what they're capable of doing. So that's a thing, I don't know what exists. In the United States, I think they're called loan sharks. In Israel, they're called the gray market. No, the bank is not the same, I'm sorry. The bank will not break your legs. And the bank will hopefully have a more decent settlement. So the Torah warns us that interest is called neshech. It says, why is it called neshech? Because it's like a snake bite. A snake bite, you don't feel the venom running through your veins. Until it hits the heart and the person starts dying, he doesn't realize it's that bad that the snake bit him. That's what interest is like. You enter a deal and it starts and you don't know where it's going to end. So the Torah warns us, don't pay interest, don't take interest. There's a mitzvah, help your brother live with you.
But how can you be a Jew and a banker if you cannot take interest?
It's a good question for Thursday night.
I used to be a banker myself, and we took a lot of interest in people.
The Torah tells us if we purchase a servant, we have to treat them respectfully. We cannot tell them, do this work indefinitely. And then eventually I'll tell you when to stop. No, we cannot give them pointless labor. We have to treat them respectfully. It says if there's one pillow in the house, who gets the pillow? Servant. If you're sitting down for a meal and you have good wine, you got to give him from that wine. The wine, yeah. You're supposed to treat him respectfully. It says when you purchase a Jewish servant, it's as though you're purchasing a brother. The master must treat the servant like a brother. The servant must treat the master as a king. So this is one of those relationships where it only works if each side is focused on what they're supposed to be giving, not what they're supposed to be receiving. If the master says, you're supposed to treat me like a king, so he's going to look back and say, you're supposed to treat me like the brother of the king. You know, that's not going to work. The only way it could work is if each one is focused on what they're supposed to give. The Torah tells us what happens if your relative sells himself to a non-Jew. So that's it. He's not going to keep any Torah mitzvos. You have to buy him out. So what happens? This guy is a gambler. He's going to go and sell himself again and again and again. So it says, okay, so buy him and keep him as your own servant. You don't have to pay for his foolishness and then pay for it again and again and again. So at some point you buy him and you say, you're not free. You're my servant. You're not his servant. You're mine. So you sold yourself to a non-Jew and I had to buy you out. That doesn't mean you're free to do it a second time. Now you're mine. Now you're going to work for me till you work off the years I just paid for you. So the Torah gives us a system. We didn't go into all the details, but the point of the system is to help people get back on their feet with the mitzvah of giving loans, with the mitzvah of not taking interest or paying interest, with the mitzvah of buying back a relative. Obviously, this is against the Torah's approach. A person should not sell himself to a non-Jew. It's considered very wrong that he did that, because he basically put himself in a situation where he's guaranteed he won't keep Torah and mitzvos. But if he did that wrong move, we have to help him get out of it.